Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to inspiring women about their successes and their challenges to help us think differently in our own lives. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Jackie Beltrow. Hello and welcome, Jackie.
Hello, Nikki. Lovely to be here.
Oh, thank you so much for your time. Now, Jackie is a former Sky Sports presenter and now Sky News presenter and well-known sportscaster and an Olympian gymnast and a mother of three. So, Jackie, you are an incredible Olympian gymnast athlete. Wow.
Oh, it seems so long ago now. It's another lifetime. But I went to the Olympics in 84. I was a rhythmic gymnast. And it's weird, actually, because, you know, I got my cancer diagnosis, first of all, 7 years ago. And people go, oh, it must be the worst thing that's ever happened to you. And I'm like, no. The worst thing that ever happened to me just before the Olympics. And having sort of set my sights on this big goal, which was to be an Olympian, all my life from the age of about eight. The thing that happened to me just before the Olympics was my mum died. She just dropped dead really suddenly. She was 42, and it was awful. And I spent that whole year, you know, trying to qualify for the Olympics, kind of in her memory, really. And that's what spurred me on. And I think that's one of, you know, it is the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my life. But I do feel that she must have been very proud, because I did get to the Olympics in 84. I had a terrible games. I performed really badly. And I think having held it together in that year that my mum died, when I finally got out on the floor to compete, I just slightly fell apart, I think, a little bit. And back in the day, you know, nobody ever counseled you in those situations. It was almost like, oh, well, you know, life goes on, pull yourself together. You know, I don't remember a single, you know, bit of professional help. And I turned to my sport really to get over this big tragedy, you know, in my life that no one saw coming. And and I was very grateful. I was very grateful to have that, you know, that day-to-day training to fall back on, and that, you know, that goal of the Olympics to sort of aim towards, you know, in those sort of 12 months between, you know, going and my mum dying. And and I did get a letter actually in the post not long ago, and it was from the British Olympic Committee, and it just said, once an Olympian, always an Olympian. And that's the thing, you can't actually call anyone former Olympian. You are always an Olympian. It's a bit like a president of the United States. You are always an Olympian. You are never a former Olympian. So that was one good achievement in my young life.
One good achievement. I mean, it's a lifetime achievement, and, you know, amazing to be an Olympian gymnast. And I'm so sorry for, you know, that tough time you went through with your mum, and so young, my goodness. And as you say, no help then, which thank goodness is more available now, particularly with everything we're going through, and you touching on your cancer so openly there, and we will come and talk about that in depth shortly. But, you know, to dwell on being a gymnast and being an Olympian, not a former Olympian gymnast, but an Olympian gymnast. And I know it was funny, in another interview you said it was a long time ago, and the children were impressed that it was in California and hadn't noticed that it said that you'd been an Olympian. That was brilliant.
I didn't actually have that. You know, as time goes by, you lose stuff. And I did have loads of stuff when I came back from Los Angeles, you know, memorabilia that I bought. And I obviously, over the years, you know, bits and pieces have gone missing. But my Olympic certificate was really lovely and was in my father's house. And when he died, I took it and put it in my downstairs loo. And it's all lovely and embossed. It says, congratulations on competing. It's got my name. Congratulations on competing in the 1984 Olympics, Los Angeles, California. And I remember hanging it. My daughter was about nine, and she, Amelia, ran into the loo, and then she ran out of the loo again. Went, oh my God, mummy, I can't believe it. I can't believe you've been to California. And it was like, you know, that's not the point of that certificate. The point of it is it's an Olympic certificate. And she went, oh yeah, but you know, loads of Olympians. You're always talking to them. But to be in California, where they made Hannah Montana, that's amazing. Money.
They love that, don't they? LA, the prospect of that. Gosh, well, very impressive. And you must have a medal. I hope you haven't lost that.
Oh no, there's a medal, of a competing medal downstairs. I didn't actually win a medal because, as I said, I had a terrible games. I literally have a bag of medals from my whole of my career as a gymnast. British titles, Coventry titles, West Midlands titles, you know, international titles. And I think they're literally in a bag in the shed.
No, they need to be out of the shed on that beautiful wall that I can see behind you with all that art.
My husband's 10 10K winter run medals are hanging on the wall in our bedroom.
Oh.
But gymnastics medals, which are like national titles.
Exactly. I think you need to be on the other side. There's some disparity there, but we won't dwell on that.
I know, but you sort of just move on to the next thing, don't you? And it's...
Oh, my goodness. No, you need to dwell on that elation. And you're such a positive role model for women in sport. You've worked on Sky Sports for a long time, now work on Sky News. You obviously have to have a lockdown home studio. How does that work then?
Well, I don't actually have to have a lockdown home studio. And in the first lockdown, I was going through chemotherapy. So I didn't really want to be going in and out of the studio. And my employers didn't want that at all either. So they set me up with a kit, which was a camera. It's really clever. One of the cameramen put it together. It's sort of a series of iPads. One of them's the auto cue. One of them is I can see myself back. And one of them I can see Sky News. So it all sort of works when you just literally turn it on. And I stand in my kitchen and in front of my sports wall, which I've kind of tailored to have. I've taken all the kids off the wall and they've been replaced by Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer and all my other pictures.
Put your medals up on that wall. Put your medals, get them out of the shed on that wall. That's the thing. People can play, can't they, in their house. They can theme different rooms and different zones. I think it's brilliant.
And I get quite cross when I see people who were appearing on television regularly and they obviously have this room where they, you know, broadcast from on their computer. And it just looks a shambles. I'm like, oh my God, make an effort, tidy up your broadcasting room, for God's sake. What are you thinking?
With interesting objects on shelves and everything as well.
Yeah, definitely. So but I'm now broadcasting from home again because I might need an operation in a couple of weeks. And the sort of laws of operations right now is that the person having the operation has to self-isolate in their own house for 2 weeks. So I can't see the children or my husband or anything. I just have to make sure I'm in a room that they're not in. Gosh. Yeah, so broadcasting is fine because it's so early, then they're not around, so I literally just see the dog.
Oh yes, what time do you get up? Because you do the sunrise, don't you, the broadcast?
It's now called Sky Breakfast, which I keep forgetting because I've worked on sunrise for so many years. I mean, you know, 2 decades really. I keep getting the name wrong because they've changed it. But I get up at about, if I'm going into the studios, which I have been until now, usually about 3:45.
Oh, my word.
And then at home, obviously, you're cutting out the driving time, which is great. So, yeah. I don't know, 4:15, I can probably push it to.
A bit of a lion. Amazing. But, you know, as you say, you know, our blessings and prayers are with you. You've put so bravely and openly discussed your health. And lockdown has been particularly challenging for you, hasn't it, with your family, with the return of cancer. You must be so shocked and in disbelief with it all.
Do you know, in the first lockdown, I found this tiny lump, bizarrely on the same side that I'd had a mastectomy. So it was just above where the boob is and, you know, below the collarbone. And it was a very tiny little thing. And I just thought, oh, it cannot possibly be. And I had it checked and no one thought it was anything, maybe a fatty deposit or something like that. And, but obviously my surgeon had to do a biopsy and really thoroughly check it. And he came back, you know, a few days later saying, yeah, it's a stage 3 and it's a very aggressive cancer. And we need to get on this very quickly and we need to see if it's gone anywhere else. And I just didn't think for a minute, how could it have possibly gone anywhere else? Because I'd had proper scans and also
mammogram, wasn't it? You had
mammogram, in January, and this was June. So, and they were completely clear. They were completely fine. So January to June, not very long. And suddenly I've got this little thing and he's saying, we have to see if it's gone somewhere else. I'm thinking, how? No way can it have gone anywhere else. And it had gone into the lymph nodes behind my chest. And because it's gone outside of the chest area, the breast area, that is now considered a stage 4 cancer. It's moved. And that is considered incurable. So they are on a mission to, you know, keep it contained, keep it dampened down, you know, for as long as possible to stop it going anywhere else. You know, that's the position that I found myself in now. And it was really hard to get my head around that. And I don't think you ever do get your head around it. It's the last thing I think about when I go to bed at night. It's the first thing I think about when I wake up in the morning. I try and change the thoughts quickly as soon as I think of it, but it's hard not to think of it straight away. And it's hard not to think of it when you're awake at night. People say, you know, have you got used to it? And I don't think you ever really do. It's just something that, you know, I've got to live with. And it's a hurdle I've got to, you know, try and get over on a daily basis. And it's not easy. And for anyone in this situation, they'll know it. It's just, you know, it's not easy. It's all consuming. It takes up all of your thought processes. And it's very hard to plan ahead because you don't know what ahead is.
Gosh, Jackie, you're so brave and open. And thank you for sharing that. That's so harrowing and heart-wrenching to hear. But you have had such amazing, generous support from your 90,000 followers who love you on social media, and celebrities such as Ben Shepherd and Eamon Holmes, and your friends with Judy Murray, aren't you? And messages. And you've been told you've defied medical odds already, though, haven't you? And it's shrinking. You keeping it under control?
I don't know if it's defying medical odds. I mean, the thing is with what people don't understand with secondary cancer is you can sort of put it in a box for a while, but it always finds a way to get out of the box eventually. And the trick is to keep it in the box as long as possible. And that's what you never know, you know. So you could have I recently had a good scan. It was pretty good, and everything on the right was dampened down, and it was smaller, and the tablets I'm taking are really working. But then there was a lymph node that sort of popped up under my left arm that looked like it was doing something weird. And now they're trying to get to the bottom of that. And luckily you can easily feel it, and it can be taken out. So that's actually an option. Which is why I'm self-isolating, that they will probably take that out. But at the moment, they can't get to the bottom of why it's like that. They can't even tell me if it's cancer or something else. But you are always playing that. It feels like you're playing whack-a-mole. You know, you like bash down two moles and then another one pops up somewhere else. And that's kind of the game that I'm now in. And you have to just try and come up with the fear of the future or lack of, and just think about what you're doing now, and appreciate what you're doing now, and be happy for what you're doing now and what you've got now, rather than be constantly striving for this, you know, this idyllic future, which you don't know about. No one does, actually.
No. And in fact, that will help so many people, Jackie, because, you know, bringing it back to the present moment and mindfulness, none of us know about the future. And hopefully, you know, with your health, and you look so radiant and healthy, and you are so physically fit and, you know, mentally fit and everything, that hopefully, you know, because they reduce your chemo to less sessions, that must be good news that you've got ahead. And, you know, the way you think and the way you speak out to share your journey is so brave. So how are the children coping? Because they were so young, weren't they, 7 years ago with your first drama that you had with stage two?
Yeah, they were young. My daughter was doing her O-levels, her GCSEs at the time. I don't know why I call them O-levels. That was me. she was doing GCSEs in a time warp. And my boys were younger. I think at the time, Amelia's very practical, and she's very much, come on, Mum, you'll be fine. You're not going to die. Pull yourself together. She's very much of that ilk. And she definitely shields me from her worry about me. But I do remember when she was doing her GCSEs, she was getting a D in RE, and she kept getting this bad mark, and the teacher was on her back the entire time. And she just stood up one day and went, my mum's got cancer. And then the teacher's like, oh. And then she just started crying. And that's the only real wobble that she's had about it. And the boys were very, didn't really understand. The difference this time was they really understand. And of course they've got the internet and they've got the dreaded Google. And, you know, Tiago, my middle son, was so upset. They were all upset, but he was like visibly crying, and, you know, he's this big giant, you know, 19-year-old, and he was just, you know, he was actually going to university and you know, didn't want to go. And I said, you've got to go, you know, you've got to go, you've got to get on with your life. And he went, I don't want to go. And my youngest son was meant to be going to university as well. And he took a gap year, because he said, Mum, I didn't want both of us going, you know, and you're in this terrible situation. Yeah. So Tiago can go, I'll stay. So he's on a gap year. And now Tiago's back from uni because, you know, all the kids came back for Christmas and never went back. So I've got a house full of kids.
So you've got all that lovely quality time with them rather than an empty nest surrounding you with love. Oh, they sound fabulous how they're dealing with it. And your daughter's amazing, isn't she? I know she often appears with you and is such a support to you. And she works at Sky as well, doesn't she?
She does. I mean, and some people go, oh, you've got her a job. I actually never did get her a job at Sky. I got her a non-paid job when she was 15 because I needed a runner at Wimbledon where I was working. I've done about 20 Wimbledons. And she used to train at Wimbledon because they ran a community scheme there. So she knew the complex like the back of her hand because she'd been playing there since she was 4 years old. And they needed someone to go over to this side of the ground and pick up a tape and take it back. And we didn't have anyone to do it. And she just did it. She sort of just helped out. And she did it for nothing. And then from there, you know, in her holidays, she's become, she applied to be a runner at Sky, which basically a script runner is you're just helping with scripts and the newspaper review and, you know, fetching coffees and, you know, very, very beginning of the ladder of TV. And she's been doing that ever since. But she, you know, she's done a journalism degree at Cardiff and she's also got a postgrad from the Press Association. And she's now trying to take that next step into getting a proper job. But it's all happened in lockdown, this. So it's really, really difficult. And I feel, you know, I feel really sorry for any young person trying to make that career step from university because this has happened just at the very wrong time.
Yes, there's not a right time for any of them, isn't there? Well, good for her. And, you know, she's following in your footsteps in terms of her role model and being, you know, she's inspired by you and interested in the same things. And isn't that amazing and fun for you both?
Yeah. I mean, all my kids have become real news bunnies, actually. And I don't know if it's the whole Trump influence that has just made them engage,
yes,
you know, in politics and the news and also, you know, Brexit and Boris and, you know, the whole dramas that we've had in the last few years just seem to be this weird time in politics that we'll probably never get again. And it's just made, I think it's made young people very much more aware of what's going on, aware of politics, and that, you know, if they don't want rubbish things to happen or people in power that they don't want, well, they need to be blooming well engaged in it and get out there and vote.
Yes, they're amazing the way they think, aren't they? They're so ahead. I've got teens myself and they're the same, you know, they're so aware of everything. It's brilliant. Yeah. Now, thank goodness you followed your own advice, as you said, because you have encouraged women, you know, to check themselves for ages. And how often should they do that, do you recommend? And how they do that?
Blimey, I would do it every month. I would do it every month because you could just and be very thorough. I mean, I wasn't checking. I was doing a yoga sort of post-warm down thing. And I was, I don't know, I was just fiddling really. And I was doing this and I was like, God, what is that? What is that? What is that? And it wasn't even a check. It was just, I was just, you know, fiddling around. And if I'd been a bigger person or a, you know, bit more of a chunkier person, I doubt I would have found it because it was, you know, it was just such a small thing that I found. Gosh, but I'm quite body aware and I'm always, you know, picking at little things that I see and going, what the hell's that? What, you know, what is that? I always think the worst. It generally is then, you know.
But you don't think the worst because I've heard you talk about the affirmations on World Cancer Day recently and that awful saying, you know, prepare for the worst and hope for the best. And you've changed that, haven't you? Put a positive spin on it. What do you say?
I know. Well, the thing is, I was listening to Greg James on Radio 1 the other day and he was, I don't know what the situation was, but he was trying to get out this saying and he kept getting it wrong. He was going like, prepare for the worst, expect the worst. No, that's not it. Prepare for the worst, you know, hope for the best. Anyway, I just thought, no, you can't sit there and, you know, prepare for the worst. That's just expecting it to happen. So no. So you've got to prepare for the best, you know, so always think of the best, always think of your best future, always think of the best thing you could be doing this time next year or this time next month. Always think of the best thing and fill your mind with the best positive thoughts on any subject. Not the worst. You know, I've got an exam coming. I'm bound to fail. No, I'm bound to pass. I'm trying to get into this university. I'm bound not to get in. No, I'm bound to get in. I'm not going to get that job. I went to the interview. No, I am going to get that job. Think of the best. So prepare for the best and hope for the best.
Definitely, which is a brilliant way of looking at it. And you are going to defeat this. And you know, looking at how positive you are and how healthy you are going to defeat this. And do you have affirmations that you say to yourself or visualization? What sort of things do you say to yourself? Are you allowed?
I had, like you said, I had loads of support on social media. And there was a lady in Northern Ireland, who got in touch with me via Facebook on a messenger. And I never use Facebook, really. It's one of the things that I'm pretty lax on. And she said, look, Jackie, you know, I saw your story. I just want you to know, I think you'll be all right. I had this terrible diagnosis 25 years ago when I was 55, same age as you. I'm 75 now, 20 years ago. And she said, you know, you don't have to believe what they tell you, and you don't have to believe the statistics. You can kind of make your own outcome. And she did that by doing a lot of meditating, by doing a lot of positive affirmations. And she would say, you know, every time she went to make a cup of tea, thank you, God, for my perfect healing. And she said, I said that about 20 times a day. I would imagine the cancer tumors as little men, like, you know, the seven dwarfs. And they would be taken away on a big yellow bus. And I made up a little song. So I imagine mine as gremlins. So there's a nice gremlin that kind of is controlling it all, but then all the others are kind of evil gremlins, and they've got a big yellow bus. And, you know, I set a song to Elton John's Yellow Brick Road, and the bus eventually gets filled up with gremlins and goes down the yellow brick road. I'm not going to sing the song because I changed the words. And I copied her mantra, which was, you know, thank you, God, for my perfect healing. And then I added in things like, I can, I am. And I've added in things like, I am a responder, meaning, you know, I'm responding to the treatment. I am a responder. I'm not going to imagine that I'm not responding to treatment. Anything really. And I try and sort of let go of, you know, the cells, the cancer cells, or the cancer, you know, tumors or whatever they are. I just go, oh, I'll let you go. You're no good to me. Just leave. And they do.
Well, that's a beautiful way to think, though, as well, isn't it? Because I saw a photo of you on social media holding a card, which obviously had a gremlin on it. So people that are aware of your stories obviously know that it was a pink gremlin, wasn't it?
Yeah, my son painted that. He's an artist. Oh, yeah. And he painted the gremlin for me, because they know that I imagine them as like naughty, really naughty little gremlins, you know, living in my lymph nodes. Gosh, and then I also visualized as well. I spoke to another lady who was very good on kind of the mental side of dealing with cancer. And she said, imagine there's a sunroof in your head or a trap door, which you can open, and all the sunlight comes in the top of your head, and that floods your whole body with perfect light. So I do that. But then I also imagine little fairies coming in like commandos in black pantsuits with wands, and they all go, and then they surround all the cancers, and then they just basically chuck out Harry Potter spells at them, like Bombarda or Reducto. I can imagine this. And then they pack up little sleepy cancer cells in their backpacks, and they look like gremlins, and then they leave on wires up through the trapdoor.
Gosh, I so hope and pray, you know, for you that this will help. And I'm sure it will. And in fact, I know a girlfriend who has, she does natural therapies, and she treats a lot of people with cancer. And even her own father was given a very short time. And she did visualization with him on the phone. And he has been in the paper because he's lived, you know, another 25 years at least from when he was told he had 6 months. So it's just the power of the mind. I really believe that myself as well, the mindset. And you've got such a positive mindset. I know you'll do this. And how lovely to be inspired from people on Facebook and some of your fans and people that listen to you. And I hope she must know that.
I'm in contact with her regularly, and I would love to meet her, actually. I would love to go and say, you know, she did me such a great service.
Wow, you must. Oh, I'm sure she'd be delighted to meet you. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
And, you know, you've generated awareness, because the awareness, and I was reading, you know, when I was researching this yesterday, that 55,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer every year, and 80% of them are over 50. And those statistics are quite alarming, aren't they, in terms of, you know, it's such a cruel thing. And actually, you pointing out that it was so high near the collarbone, a lot of women don't realise how high the breast tissue actually goes.
No, actually, I didn't know. I thought if I'd had a mastectomy, that would be the end of any troubles I would ever have on that side. But that's not the case.
And having a mammogram as well, you just think that's it, for I'm okay for 3 years, you know. But so that, you know, you're doing so much for healing yourself, and for helping so many other women. And I know that you said you're passionate about yoga. I've saw you online with your dog. I think he was sniffing your face or licking your face or something while you were upside down. So, and you've talked about your beautiful children. They sound amazing. Your daughter brought you a dress and your son's painted you a picture. They're three beautiful children and three adorable white fluffy dogs. Tell me, is that one for each child? What are they called, your lovely dogs?
No, they wasn't really planned. So I've got Maddie, I've got Teddy and I've got Lily. And we got Maddie. Maddie's 15, although there's an argument in our house that she's 16. We don't really know. The kids were very small and we wanted a dog. And I was going to all these breeders trying to get a Cairn Terrier and none of them would sell one to me. And the kids were too boisterous and too small. And they said, oh, I don't think this is on, do you? And I said, oh, for God's sake. And I met a lady from the Dogs Trust and she was the chief of the Dogs Trust, Lady Clarissa. And she said, she came into Sky to talk about not getting dogs for Christmas. What a bad idea it was. And I said, you know what, Clarissa, I've been trying to get a dog and I really want a dog, but no breeders will let me have one. And she said, oh, don't worry, I'll find you a lovely dog. And sure enough, she gave me a call a few weeks later and said, there's a lovely dog that's come into the Liverpool Homing Centre. It's a cross between a Westie and a Bichon. Would you like to meet it? And I was like, I wouldn't like to meet it. I just want her. I want her now. And I, you know, they checked out my, you know, living conditions and all the rest of it. And we got Maddie and she was, you know, one of the big loves of my life. And she's still going strong. She doesn't like walking so much because her hips are a bit dodgy, but
I've got the same problem at the moment.
Oh God. And then she was getting quite lazy. And about, I want to say 7 years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, I rang the Dogs Trust again. And by this point, I'm an ambassador for the Dogs Trust. And I've already roped in Eamon, you know, to get a dog from the Dogs Trust and Charlotte from Good Morning Britain. And we're all like big Dogs Trust fans. And I just rang them and said, look, I need a friend for Maddie. She's become so, so lazy and sort of fat and menopausal. And can you please find me a little friend for her? And they said, yeah, we'll keep an eye out. And this dog came in and it was a little fluffy Bichon cross with a Jack Russell who'd been bought by a professional guy who worked all day and left the puppy at home. And the puppy was really sad and kept chewing everything. And he just thought, this isn't fair. And the puppy was doing quite badly in the kennels. And they said, we need to get, you know, to get him out of the kennels as quickly as possible. So I loaded all the kids in the car and Maddie, and we went down to see this little dog. And the kids were like, Mom, what if Maddie doesn't like him? And what if the cats don't like him? And Mom, what are you doing? I went, it'll be fine. Everybody will get used to everybody. And they were like, Dad's going to go mad. Mom, what are you doing? And I am quite sort of headstrong like this. And they just, Maddie didn't mind him. And literally they fast tracked me because they knew me and Teddy was in the car.
I thought they were all the same. I thought they were triplets.
And then Teddy, you know, was such a darling dog. We just think he's the best dog in the world. He's so gentle and lovely. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, I was looking for a dog for my friend in Jersey because her dog had died. And I was doing some work for the Dogs Trust and said, you know, is there anything good? And she said, oh, actually, we've had loads of dogs in from a house in the Isle of Wight. A breed has gone a bit rogue and we've had to rescue all the dogs. And these dogs have been in cages for 8 months. So they're a bit backwards. You know, they don't really understand how to be a dog. And I said, oh, these, so I went to see them and the dogs were so cute. And one in particular kept coming over to me and jumping on me and she was lovely. And they said, we cannot let your friend have this dog. It's got to go to a dog house, a house with other dogs like yours. And I went, oh, but she's so cute. And they were like, yeah, isn't she? They knew that I would take her.
Don't have any more. But they do look beautiful. And I love seeing them, you know, copying you with your yoga. And you upside down. How clever is that?
Well, I was an ex-gymnast, so I like being upside down.
You are an Olympian gymnast, so being upside down is the answer. And that's what keeps you so healthy. And I think it's incredible.
Dogs are important, though. They're an important part of, you know, your mental health, I think, because they do live in the moment. They just don't know anything about time. Yesterday, tomorrow, a week, you know, a week. They just don't know that. So
they just give love, don't they? And one of us is watching us at the moment, aren't they? That's
oh, Lily was watching, now she's got bored and gone. What's it's funny doing? In lockdown you see a lot more dogs, actually. People have,
I know, I feel so envious actually that I haven't got one at the moment, thinking, I mean, maybe I need to talk to your dogs trust. But I think it's incredible the work you're doing, you know, for dog awareness, for giving a voice and awareness for cancer, and the fear and unknown of what chemotherapy entails. I mean, yeah. I saw you with a cold cap on. I mean, it must be terribly scary and cold. And I know you said you have a hot water bottle or something. Is it really, really freezing and feeling lonely?
Bizarrely, I actually really wanted the chemotherapy this time because I knew it could do a good job. And the first time, you know, it was terrifying, but I knew what was coming. So it wasn't... a friend of mine had been through it for a second time last year, and I went with her to some of the sessions. So I knew exactly, you know, what to expect. It wasn't a surprise. And the cold cap, funnily enough, doesn't affect me that much. My sister said I've got a high pain threshold. I don't think I have, but, you know, I just put it on, grit my teeth, and the first 10 minutes are the worst, and, you know, then your head's numb and you can't really feel it anyway. So I just, you know, put it on, go to sleep, and wake up when the chemo's, you know, been administered and it's all done and dusted. It is scary at first, the thought of doing chemo, but you have to remember at the end of the day, it's just medicine. And if someone said to you, you have to go into hospital to have an antibiotic drip because you've had an operation and the antibiotic drip's going to take 40 minutes, you wouldn't freak out. You just go, oh, okay. That's, and it really is the same. It's just different. It's just different medicine. And yes, of course, it affects your hair follicles and your hair falls out and all the rest of it. But in terms of what it's, you know, it's probably more intense medicine than antibiotics. But the process is the same. It's an injection that's going into you, and you know, and that's all it is. That's all it is. Gosh, it's nasty medicine, but it is. That's all it is. It's just medicine.
You're amazing the way you think. And have you been able to have the coronavirus injection? Or
yeah,
you have already had that because you've had to be very careful, obviously, to not get anywhere near getting that. And to have a treatment in the middle of lockdown must have been delayed or difficult.
No, actually, I think, to be fair to everybody, I think cancer treatment generally has gone ahead for people who've really, really needed it. And the places where it's been delayed are perhaps people where it's less urgent, maybe it's a slow growing cancer and the chemo could be put off, or a different sort of, or a different order of treatment could be given. You know, take these tablets first and we'll deal with your operation later down the line. But for people who've really been in an urgent situation like me, you know, I got exactly what I needed. The only issue was, you know, if you're going to chemo, they didn't really want anyone going in with you. I actually did twist my oncologist's arm and she did let my husband come in with me. And that was very, very lucky. Yeah, that was very lucky. But a lot of people were doing it on their own. But, you know, you can look upon it as a time, you know, to sit down and do some reading, or I used to take a sleeping tablet and just sleep.
Wow.
And just have a hot water bottle. And a friend of mine who's she's very kind, actually, because I don't see her very often, and she's not like a super, super close friend, but she sent me a cashmere blanket and it was the best thing ever. I would just get into the hospital and wrap myself in this blanket.
How thoughtful. And I think actually that sort of softness and feeling, you know, I'm craving in lockdown, you know, softer fabrics. I think they're just giving people some level of comfort, aren't they? How thoughtful of her.
And a hat, and a cashmere hat to match. And so when I came out, my head was literally full of icicles. I would just put on this hat. It was just like, oh, my head is so warm now.
Oh, what a lovely friend.
It was lovely. And I think, you know, if anyone's going through cancer or chemo or treatment or whatever, just spoil yourself, I would say. You know, do spoil yourself, do go online and do internet shopping and do buy nice cozy warm things, and if you don't want to make the dinner, don't make it.
Perfect. And I hope you've got something to look forward to when you come out, some lovely takeaway and some retail therapy. But you thankfully made it out to your lovely holiday home in Brazil, in Rio. We're all jealous of that, for some Christmas sunshine. Did you get this? Is your husband from Brazil?
I timed that so well. My husband is Brazilian, and it's actually not a holiday home. We go there on holiday, but it's my mother-in-law's house. And she lives alone, so you know, we don't like, and she was supposed to come for Christmas, but she couldn't. So it was bizarre. We booked this holiday and I thought, let's go just before Christmas, but be back in time for my daughter's birthday on the 14th of December. And literally, we booked this holiday without knowing when lockdowns were starting, finishing, whatever, whatever. And we came out of one lockdown, and the very next day we travelled. So that was absolute luck that we were allowed to travel. And we got back, and I think about a week later, we went back into some kind of lockdown. So it was an incredible stroke of luck to be able to get to Brazil and have a break. And, you know, there was less strict, you know, there's less strict lockdown there. You know, restaurants are open, people wear masks and social distance, but everything is open as normal. And it was actually very nice just to be in that, yes, you know, environment, order a meal, order a drink on the beach.
It
was such a break. It was such a lovely, you know, a world away from here in London.
Definitely. And what you needed, and you'd already had your diagnosis and you'd had your jab and you wore a mask and, you know, had that long flight.
I did take a risk by going, but my thought is everything's a risk, really. And you can either never take a risk for the rest of your life. I'll never get insurance for traveling with breast cancer ever. So, you know, I either travel and take the risk, or I don't ever go anywhere ever again.
It's a calculated risk, isn't it? And, you know, obviously one that did you good.
I'm healthy. What's likely to go wrong? Really, you know, nothing. I'm much more likely to, I don't know, get diarrhea or, you know, have a runny tummy or, you know, whatever. I'm not likely to be affected by traveling because of my condition.
And, you know, as this podcast, as we've mentioned, it is about adversity, you know, and with thrivers and survivors, and you definitely are those. And, you know, in lockdown, it must have been incredibly hard, and much harder than it is for a lot of people who, but you follow a very healthy lifestyle, don't you? And you've probably always done that with your incredible, you know, Olympian. But what have you done with your diet and exercise lately to make adjustments? You've gone dairy free.
Well, I went dairy free at my last diagnosis. I read a book by Jane Plant, and she'd had breast cancer 6 times, and she was a scientist, and she figured out that, why is this coming back? I think it's something I'm eating. And she's cut out dairy, and that was pretty much the end of her breast cancer. So I thought, okay, there's a lot of hormones in milk. I will stop eating dairy. So all the milk went out the window and it was replaced with, you know, almond milk. And it was difficult actually 7 years ago, because today there are so many more options of, you know, free from foods. Back then it was a bit of a struggle actually. What can I use instead of butter? It was like everything's got milk in it or some kind of milk substitute or, you know, anyway. So I gave up dairy. And then this time it was really giving up sugar. And because the cancer is in me and I can't get it out, how do I starve it? So that was another book, Jane McClellan's book, How to Starve Your Cancer. Really, really useful book. And various other books as well about the keto diets. So I went on a keto diet while I was on chemotherapy. So I was eating no sugar really at all. So no bread, no pasta, no rice, nothing, no carbs. And I love carbs. I love carbs so much. And I love rich tea biscuits. They're one of my favorite things in the world. It's like, you know, one of your children or rich tea biscuits forever. Which one is it going to be? I mean, you know.
It's a hard way.
Oh, God. So anyway, I just gave it all up, and I was eating this very sad, very proteiny, very veggie diet, but no meat. So it was, and no dairy. So this diet normally is full of cheese and things like that, but I don't eat cheese. So it was like, oh, it was salad for everything and no fruit. And it was very sad, but I stuck to it. And it did sort of reap rewards for the first part of my chemo, I think. I did lose a lot of weight, though, which I still haven't put
so up. Yes, there were not many calories there, gosh. But yes, it's maintaining that.
I lost about a stone. So that was a bit sad. So I, once I'd finished chemo, I thought, I can't keep this up. I need to eat some more things. So I added in oats for breakfast. Ooh. And then I gradually added in some gluten-free bread. And I don't really eat much bread, maybe half a slice a day or something like that. But it's always either sourdough, which is good for your gut, or something that's got loads of fiber in it. And I added in, you know, baked potatoes, sweet potatoes and brown rice.
I think you could write a book yourself on all of this with your health and, you know, obviously, you know, when you're well, that may be a future idea of yours. So who's inspired you in your life as an influential woman then?
Oh, my God. Who's inspired me? Oh, well, we were playing a game last night and it was who's your favourite actress? And my favourite actress, and it's not really for her acting, it's just because of who she is Jane Fonda. You know, she's still acting. She's 80-something.
She was a campaigner.
She was always stood up for what she believed in. She survived breast cancer herself, several marriages. And I just thought she'd be a great role model, you know, a great person. If you could live a life like that, you know, that would be a good life to have. I found her very inspiring. Grace and Frankie, you know, the latest series that she's done. And I loved watching that. And I thought, you know, good for you creating a series for older women, because there aren't any, you know, that just, I find age isn't the most annoying thing about life.
Gosh, that's so true. I must watch that. That's interesting.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. So, I mean, she's a sort of inspirational figure recently. I suppose when I was young, it was Nadia Comaneci, because I wanted to go to an Olympics and she was like the ultimate Olympian as far as I was concerned. And people I've interviewed along the line, you know, Serena Williams, I mean, my goodness, the greatest tennis player, female of all time, possibly tennis player of all time. And, you know, come through a lot of adversity herself and from a really poor background. And I came from a really poor background as well. You know, we never had anything when I was growing up. And just for me to do gymnastics was a real struggle for my parents and, you know, couldn't afford any of the kits and definitely didn't have it easy when I was young. And I always admire people who come from, to have that grit and hunger to come from, you know, nothing to create something amazing that, you know, the way she did. I always find it so, you know, so impressive and so inspirational.
Gosh, yes, some amazing. And obviously, you know, you, as you say, you've worked at Wimbledon for such a long time and, you know, passionate about tennis. And do you have a mantra for how you live your life then?
Gosh, no, I don't. Try not to eat any biscuits today. It's definitely got to be one of my mantras. Try not to drink loads of wine at the weekend. That could be another one. I try to be happy, and it's been difficult for me in this, this latest cancer situation, about not always projecting forward to the future. I'm always thinking about what house could we live in next? Because my kids always go mad at me because we move house quite a lot, because I'm always doing up houses, but we never get a better house. We just get the same house slightly better. And in the meantime, we move into a much more rubbish house and we do it up and we start, you know, we literally live in a bomb site for a year and everyone just has dusty clothes and dusty faces. But I'm always thinking about the next project. What can the next project be?
What is your next project then?
Well, the thing is, it's important not to really have that. You know, why are you always trying to be better, or why are you always trying to have a better house or a bigger house or a better car, or, you know, why am I always putting myself in these, you know, difficult positions? Why can't I just be happy with what I've got?
Everything we need is inside, isn't it? That's the thing.
And I'm trying to be more content with what I've got, rather than, you know, being jealous of people who've got more or wanting more myself. And it's really difficult for me because I'm quite materialistic. So it's been very hard. I'm still not quite there, really. I mean, I bought a really expensive coat the other day, but I didn't need to bought it.
Wow, and you've got some incredible art that you know, people can't see on here, but that I'm envying in all of your photos.
You know what? We didn't buy any of those. This one, I'm in my bedroom, and that was a wedding present from Eduardo's cousin in Brazil because she owns a gallery.
Oh, wow.
That's my favourite painting. I know this is
And you've got a green one I've seen on social media as well, haven't you?
We've got a massive, massive painting in the front room. And that was done by a friend of ours. And that painting is was Eduardo's parents' painting in his house growing up. And we've just kind of, we've got it now because we happen to have a big wall, and my mother-in-law doesn't have a big wall anymore. So she was going to sell it and I just said, no, I wouldn't let her, because a lot of pictures of the children when they were very young were taken in front of that painting. Aww. So that was, again, it was a family friend that did it. It wasn't like we bought left art. We were very lucky. And my son is now an artist, so I literally have more art than I can hang up because he makes stuff all the time.
We need more gremlins. So Is there anything else you'd say to encourage women and men to be brave and as brave as you are?
I think everyone's different. I was given lots of advice at the beginning of my diagnosis this time. And one of the pieces of advice was don't talk about it, make it very small, as if it's not really there, you know, and the smaller you can make it, the less significance it's got. But I can't really follow that advice because I'm not famous, but I'm a public figure. And I also figured that if I could go out there, put a brave face on it, do my treatment, still look fine, actually try and get fitter than I've ever been while going through this, that's a good message. And it might help other people. You know, yes, the statistics aren't great for secondary cancer. Everybody knows that. But I actually haven't Googled them ever. And I just thought, why should anyone sit there and think I'm going to be an average statistic? Yeah, everyone should think that they're not average. Everyone should think they're above average, and you can beat the odds if you try. So that's what I think. You know, don't sit there and accept what the doctor says. You know, try and make yourself well.
I think you're amazing. You know how you inspire people and how you.
If I would give a message to anyone, it is your doctor is looking after your illness. That's their job, but it's up to you to look after your wellness. So look after your diet. Do some extra things. Look into supplements. Definitely keep up an exercise regime. And if you never did it before, definitely start now because it's important. You're in charge of your wellness. And the more well you are, the better equipped you are to deal with your illness.
That's so true. And I like that. Yes, the doctor looks after the illness and you look after your wellness. That's a brilliant note to encourage women particularly to check themselves regularly, as you say, monthly. And if they need any help, to contact some charities or to talk to their doctor.
You should go straight to your doctor if you find anything or you feel something's not right. And don't wait, because you're not actually doing yourself any favours by waiting. And a lot of people find lumps, bumps, dimples, and they don't go. They just put it off, or they put it down to a reason. It's happened because of this or because of that, or my bowel habits have changed because I've done this or that. Don't put it off. It's just worth getting it checked. And don't wait, you know, just do not wait, because cancer doesn't wait. And you just don't know, you know, it's probably nothing, but if it's cancer and it's a really fast one, it's doing its thing while you're hanging around dithering. So don't dither. You know, give yourself the best possible chance of getting rid of it.
Thank you so much, Jackie. And, you know, if anyone has been affected or touched by this story, please do check yourself and stay safe. Thank you, Jackie, for everything, for your inspiration, your wisdom, your bravery, open and honest story about tackling breast cancer, helping others going through the same challenges, and to help them going through lockdown, because a lot of those gifts and skills and stories you've shared will uplift and inspire people to just focus on today and deal with whatever they're going through in the positive way that you are. It shows the strength to be positive and human and show our vulnerable side, which inspires others. And we're all sending love and prayers to you to change your world and to change their own worlds. And I really hope you get better soon. And I'm sure you will, with your positivity and those gremlins and fairies helping you and that little yellow bus. So please get well. And thank you so much for your time. I know you're so busy. And thank you for squeezing us in. And please stay safe.
Oh, you too. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
The Influential Women's Podcast is co-founded and host-presented by exec producer Nikki Bannerman and audio produced by Saffron Mirza. Please subscribe for free on all podcasting platforms to hear our real-life stories out every other Tuesday.